This is the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast, episode 38. Well, good day and welcome to this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. I'm your host, podcaster, and author of Fun Fantasy Reads, Jamie Davis. This podcast is exactly what the title says it is, folks. It's a show focused on everything to do with fantasy books. Whether it's epic fantasy or urban fantasy, swords and sorcery, whatever you're looking for about fantasy books, you can expect to find the best and brightest fantasy authors from all the various corners of the fantasy book world here on the show. First off, we're going to be jumping into what I'm working on, and I just want to give a brief shout out to some folks that are helping me out. Thank you to Craig Martell, who's a great fantasy and science fiction writer, who's working with me on a project right now. And also thank you to the whole gang at the Indie Pub support group that I belong to. We got together out in Kansas City over last weekend, and they're just a great group of folks, and I just want to give them a shout out for all their continued help. And we help each other out and get our books out and get them to the readers like all of you. So I'm deep into writing book 3 of my Sapiens Run trilogy called Cyber's Underground. It's coming along nicely. I hope to finish the first draft of that book in about a week or so. And, you know, it's funny. Summertime tends to be hard. There's just lots of distractions. The weather's nice outside. There's lots of stuff that needs to get done outside the house. And I'm always pressing on getting that stuff done, plus getting my books done, plus getting everything else done. So I am working hard on getting this book finished and hope to have the whole series wrapped up hopefully by the end of this month, which is good because the release of book 2 in the trilogy, Cyber's Escape, is set for the end of the month. That's coming along and all ready to go. The audiobook's going to be ready to release everything, so keep your eyes open for that. Looking forward to helping to get that out for you, and I'll have more about that in future episodes. As always, if you're interested in more information on what I'm up to, check out my fan group over on Facebook, Jamie's Fun Fantasy Readers, and on my website and blog at jamiedavisbooks.com. I always look forward to hearing from you, so please check in with me wherever you'd like. All right, time to get into this week's episode's interview, and I was joined this time around by James Wolanik. James is a teacher and marketing specialist at an international school in Latvia, as well as a freelance editor and consultant. He studied writing under Andre Dubas while in school and has taught in 3 countries since that time. The Scribe Cycle was his traditionally published fantasy series, and he has another sci-fi thriller set to launch with Atheon Books in the next year or so. I had a great time chatting with James, so check out this episode coming right up. James, I want to welcome you to the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. It's really quite an honor to have you here on the show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Very happy to be able to grace the stage with some of the good names that I've seen before. So
it's been a lot of fun being the host of this podcast. I have to admit, you know, people like you and all the other great authors we've had on here has been a joy for me as an author and a reader to have people on. So we can kind of give the listeners a chance to get to know you for those that haven't read something that you've done in the past. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background?
Okay, very cool. So basically, the writer version of me, I've been writing for about, I don't know now, it's probably 14 years or so, because I'm 26 now, so probably 12 or a little bit earlier, I started writing stuff, and I was submitting manuscripts to agents from the age of like 15 onwards, and just, you know, getting brutal rejections and you know, the whole nine yards. But, you know, it sort of cemented, I got a post-apocalyptic book put out in 2015. And then a little while afterwards, I got my agent and put out The Scribe Cycle, which is a trilogy through Kensington, through Rebel Base, which is technically an imprint of Kensington. But that's pretty much my publishing career. And then I have a sci-fi thriller dropping out probably at the end of this year or next year sometime. I'm not too sure. But the person me might be a little bit more boring. I'm not sure. I am a teacher. I live abroad. I was born in Boston, but now I'm living in Riga, which is in Latvia. And I'm teaching English. And it's my third country so far. And yeah, most of my time is either spent at work, obviously, or obviously writing, or I really like meditation and sort of studying any sort of Eastern philosophy or whatever you might want to put that under for an umbrella. But that's kind of a summation of my life in the shortest possible time.
No, that's great. And you know, it's interesting. I'm curious, you know, when you travel the way you do and living in a different country as an American expat, do you find inspiration in the different locations in which you're living to kind of spur your writing in different directions?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I would say I do. A lot of the stuff that I've written, ironically, I get interested in the culture before I travel there. And so sometimes what ends up happening is the stuff that I write is inspired by my Google research about a certain culture or whatever. For example, in the scribe cycle there's like three kind of main languages. And you might say that they're sort of analogs of Slavic languages, sort of Hebrew and Turkish. Like those are the three sort of main analogs for the different languages. And, you know, ironically, I didn't travel to Turkey or to some of the Slavic countries until after I'd written some of those chapters. And it was really cool to kind of match my literary imagination to the real places and the real cultures. So in some ways, I'd say that it's almost like writing fuels the destinations I'd like to visit.
Did you, when you got there, did you encounter any glaring errors or assumptions that you'd made? And what kind of things did you say, oh, I should have changed this or I could have done this differently?
Yeah, it's, I mean, a lot of the things lined up. A lot of the kind of places I described in the books, especially when I visited Istanbul, you know, a lot of the desert scenes in my fantasy writing were inspired by what I knew about this region of sort of, you know, Turkey and Bulgaria to a lesser extent. But, you know, when I actually went there and I saw the architecture and the, you know, the soaring, you know, these lapis lazuli imprints and stuff, you know, there's all this beautiful stuff. And to a degree, I got it right. But also to a degree, I didn't go far enough. I mean, it wasn't ornate enough in the writing compared to what I actually saw. In a lot of other countries, it's quite the opposite. When I visited Poland, you know, the medieval charm that I tried to put into the writing is not as evident these days, of course, because, you know, now there's a bunch of Soviet architecture and modern renovations and stuff. So it really depends kind of, I guess, on how you frame the locations in your mind. If you're looking at the people, you're going to get a much different view than if you're looking, you know, you're kind of gazing up at all these historic buildings and stuff. So it depends what element of that place, I guess, finds its way into the writing.
Well, no, and I'm thinking like any writer in Paris right now, you know, that hadn't previously seen Notre Dame Cathedral wouldn't be able to adequately describe the roof because build the new one, right? So,
yeah, it's a bit of a pity there. I mean, the whole thing obviously is a tragedy, but, you know, especially I was thinking of the tourists who had just landed there that day, you know, or the people who had it, you know, circled on their maps or whatever. That's, you know, it must be crushing, you know, to be so close and, you know, have it kind of snatched away like that. It's an awful, awful thing.
So let's talk a little bit about your books, The Scribe Cycle. And the first book is Scribes, that came out about a year ago now, I think. And it's an interesting magic system that you came up with. Why don't you tell us just briefly what the book's about and then kind of go into how this magic system came to you, because it seems just the bit I've read to prepare for this interview is pretty fascinating.
Oh, thanks. So in brief, The Scribe Cycle is about Anna, who's a young girl. It's not specified, but, you know, somewhere in the range of like 13 to 15 or so. And she's living in a land that's sort of been torn apart by a civil war. Basically brutal war. And at the backbone of this war, you have these very, very rare people who are able to look at somebody and they can sort of see what you might call a camouflage print on their skin. It's sort of a repeating pattern, and it's very luminous on these people's skin. And so these people who are able to see this pattern, who are called scribes, they can then, you know, make a scarring rune onto the person with the shape of that camouflage pattern, if you will. And depending on kind of the accuracy of the cuts, or depending on, you know, there's all these minute skill-based things involved in how people do it. But, you know, suffice to say, some people can make the markings better than others. So for somebody who's not very good with their hands, or they can't quite capture the essence of this cut, you know, they might give this person invulnerability for a couple of minutes or maybe an hour. And they don't need to eat, breathe, sleep, anybody who's marked with these runes, I mean. But people who are very good with making these cuts can make them last much longer, of course. So you've got people lasting maybe a few hours, maybe up to a day. Anna, the main character, she can make these cuts for an indefinite amount of time. There's no, seemingly no end to when the power expires. So on the surface, this is, you know, kind of an overpowered character or overpowered start to the story. But it kind of becomes more of a horror bent a little bit later on, because you start to realize that the wrong people can receive these markings, and the wrong people are now walking tanks around this empire, who can just do whatever they want, and nobody can sort of stop them or slow them down. And that's sort of Anna's dilemma in the first book, is she is kind of conned into helping a war criminal, and the war criminal receives her markings and sort of uses her as a tool to rebuild an army. And she is unfortunately caught between a lot of competing powers because of her, what you might call gift, although I think the story proves that it's not much of a gift. And the magic system, it's hard to say where the kind of inspiration came from. I think it was really just, I wanted a magic system that was very visceral and something that carried its own weight when it was being performed. I don't mind magic systems like Lord of the Rings, where you have these wizards that can just kind of pull magic out of themselves. But I sort of wanted a system in which it was talking about, you know, the vulnerability of people, because these scribes, although they can make these tremendous markings on other people, they're forever kind of shut out of the power. They can never make a marking on themselves. They can never make it on another scribe. So scribes are kind of, you know, bought and sold as property items, because they can't defend themselves very well. So that was sort of, I guess, where the inspiration came from. It's like the inequality of people and the brutality that you find that's inherent with scarring people. I guess that is a more detailed explanation than what I came up with in my head, but it, in retrospect, that was sort of the driving force behind how the system was developed.
No, you know, it's interesting. I've come up with several different series and variations of different magic systems for a couple of them. And, you know, the most difficult thing that I found was coming up with the crutch or the problem with the magic system. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing mm-hmm. that made it flawed, because, you know, all power has some flaw to it, something that makes it have a weakness in some way. And usually a lot of people, and I've done this too, is they create some sort of a weight or a price that must be paid by the caster, or in your situation, the person who is the scribe, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's this anime show called One Punch Man, something like that. There's this great series where this guy, I was just so impressed with the world building. Like he can, you know, kind of kill or defeat any enemy with a single punch. But his problem is that he runs out of people that he considers worthy of fighting. So his whole arc is kind of traveling throughout the land, trying to find someone who can beat him in a fight. And I think that that's just an illustration of, you know, we as authors, I think, can be very creative in how we choose to impose these punishments on magic users or just people who are super skilled. You know, being able to make these incredible things come to life, these incredible miracles or whatever, even if the price isn't immediately obvious, I think that any time you have a person who's living outside of the normal boundaries of a society, there's going to be an inherent cost to that person's life. They, you know, they're stuck in a system that that people are probably afraid of them breaking, if that makes sense.
Oh, it absolutely does. And it's just, you know, I think it's fascinating, especially, and one of the best things about doing a fantasy show like this is that we get to talk about magic and we get to talk about how we've arrived at this, whether it's through study of existing mythology or coming up with something entirely on our own or cobbling together of the two. It's just a lot of fun, and the creativity of my fellow authors always doesn't amaze me so much as just amuse me and makes me happy to be part of this group.
Yeah, for sure. Likewise, you know, it's a good community. It's very inspiring in its own way. You know, not as a life coach thing, but just to read other people's creations and see that, you know, all these amazing ideas are sort of right around us. You know, we have to tune in a bit.
Well, and you know, it's funny. I get that question a lot from readers and from people I run into that when I tell them I'm an author, and they'll be like, "Where do you get all the ideas?" And I'm like, "You know, where do I not get the ideas?" Right?
Right. Right.
Yeah, I like what you said. Seeing them all around you, because there are stories happening every day. From, you know, the ant struggling to get the piece of potato chip across the driveway to, to the mother struggling with making a difficult phone call while her kid's at school, because of situations in her life. I mean, there's things that happen in communities everywhere. And those are stories. Those are things that have real impacts on the main character, whether it's an ant or a real person. It is. Story worthy, I guess.
Sure. I had a professor in university that I loved. There's this book called House of Sand and Fog. And I don't know if you know it. It was made into a movie with Ben Kingsley. But the author who's, you know, now he's of course living in the luxurious kind of Cape Cod mansion life. But when he was my university professor, he had a really cool quote that he had kind of stolen from like a PBS program. I don't know. He referenced it to us at the time. I can't remember it now, but basically it was, I think it was Oliver Stone who was on the show, and it was something about, talking about 9/11, like, how do you make a movie about 9/11? And his response was something like, you know, he asked, what's it like to be in this thing that's happening? Like some quote like that, you know, and it's like always stuck with me that, the story has nothing to do with the explosions or the crazy peaks and valleys that it goes through. It's sort of, you know, how close can you get to putting somebody in another living being's shoes and showing their life from that perspective? That's the real kind of intensity, I guess, or the real drama.
And that's the joy of it as a reader, and really even as an author, is that moment where you kind of get a chill because of something that happened to the character that you're reading about. You know, something about them in that moment connected with you to the point that you had an emotional response. And I don't know about you, but I find that sometimes I get it just when I'm reading through things I've written myself. You know, that there are certain passages of things I've written that really resonate with me personally. And I enjoy reading them again. And in fact, I'm moving some of my books into audiobook at this point, and, you know, I haven't really looked at them for a couple of years. And to hear those words come back to me performed by another person is quite an interesting experience. And it's almost like an out of body experience in a way that, you know, like, I don't remember writing this, or, you know, I don't remember this being this way.
Definitely.
So
yeah, it is unique.
Yeah, it is. And I was looking at your covers. They're just fantastic. And I'm sure you got, you know, your publisher took care of that. But, you know, I have to give credit where credit is due, because the covers are fascinating.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, it's they're very nice covers, and the guy who did them, I need to attach his name somewhere to a link. He actually had retweeted the covers on Twitter, and I was like, who is this guy? And I'm like, oh, it's the cover artist. And it turns out, you know, he's done work for a ton of really high profile fantasy people, and just I was floored to have actually been included with that. And of course, I know that it's not sort of that, you know, they're taking names out of a hat or whatever, that they're, you know, choosing me specifically, but just the fact that, you know, those covers were kind of the ones that he produced for it. They're always going to look really cool on a bookshelf or whatever. Just I like the color contrast a lot. Although I take no credit whatsoever for any of the design stuff, but like you said, it is kind of out of body to see somebody else, helping to illustrate your stuff, you know?
Well, and I have to say, just looking at like Scribe's cover and actually Schisms and Scions, we haven't talked about the two follow-up books, but the you get a sense of that, like you said, that pattern that might be seen. I mean, the author or the artist clearly had an idea of what that description you made earlier might mean when drawn out, when illustrated. And it's pretty fascinating to see. I urge people, you know, I want you to read his books, and James should certainly get you to read his books, but the covers are fascinating. And for no other reason, go get the covers so you see the books and the covers.
Frame
there.
Them.
Because it's funny, you know, we talk about no judge a book by its cover, but I have to say, you know, the covers are what we know as authors. The covers are what draw readers to stop.
Sure. In dime stores, maybe. Yeah. I mean, you know, read a couple pages, but yeah, when you're walking through Barnes and Noble or whatever, Borders. Okay. When Borders was alive, you know, rest in peace.
You're dating yourself.
When you're walking through these, my fiance just laughed from the other room. She found that funny, I guess. But basically I think it's like when you see these book covers that really grab you, those are some of my first memories as a kid, was going to a bookstore and, you know, just looking at the cool covers. And I remember there was like House of the Scorpion when I was younger by Nancy Farmer. It was just such a striking, cover with this weird, scorpion symbol. And of course I bought it just for that. And the book turned out incredible. And the same for a lot of other books. I think Dune, you know, I had this cover of Dune that was just sand dunes. And I was like, wow, you know, it's minimalist, but it captured everything about the story in the same time. You know, and that's, I think, what we're all striving for, is sort of how do we turn this mental image that we have, or this visual story in our heads, how do we translate that to the page? And the cover is the most accessible and the most vivid way to do that. You know, before any of the words even come to the reader.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking back to my childhood, which is farther back than yours by a good piece. but I remember being just drawn to the Robert Howard Conan covers, that were just iconic covers of the pulp fiction, the genre fiction time that they were from, you know, that just depicted Conan the Barbarian and in all of his various, you know, moments that those books captured, just drew me instantly into that fantasy genre and that swords and sorcery kind of feel.
Definitely.
So I wanted to see, we moved in, you wrote Schisms next and Scions, and it continues the story, you know, with Anna throughout what she's got to deal with as she comes to grips with some of the things that she did in book one and continues on. I know book three, Scions, just came out. Is this the end of the saga, or is there another book coming on after this?
For now, this is the end. I have another fantasy series in the works, but I think, you know, what was really beautiful about Scribes, the whole series, is like, this is the series that I've wanted to write since I was a kid. You know, this is really like a representation of all the kind of cool scenes and themes and ideas that I've really had in my head since I was like 12 or 13. And I didn't start writing this book until I was in college already, but just the fact that I could actually have that book out in public for people to read, you know, for the foreseeable future, is really crazy to me. And I think that like you said, you know, when you can kind of grow with a character in a sense, talking about how people get these out of body experiences. You know, that's really how I feel just looking back at the series and at Anna's character. And it's always interesting to me when I ask people sort of about the series, and I say like, what did you like in it or whatever, you know, and which character was your favorite? And I've had six people tell me six different characters. So it's, I really like that aspect that people kind of see something in themselves in different characters in the book. That's a very touching experience to have with your kind of first series that you put out. So I'm very grateful, regardless of whether the series keeps going or just stops there.
No, and you know, it's such a compliment to you that somebody has seen enough development of the character that they came to life to the point that they felt this connection to them. And we talked earlier about that mm-hmm. that experience where you start to share the emotions of the character in the book. And I find that it doesn't always have to be the main character. I mean, certainly you want to connect with the main character and you want to get your readers to connect. But sometimes there's things about that main character you don't necessarily want your readers to like.
Right,
but there are other characters they may more identify with.
That's very true. Very, very true.
So you said you're working on something else. Is it something you can talk about? Is it is another fantasy in the same type of vein, genre-wise, as the Scribe Cycle, or are you going somewhere completely different?
It's a funny question. I've been asking myself that a lot lately. Basically, the interim book that we've got out now is, as I said, a sci-fi thriller. But as I was working on it, I started to realize that, you know, I enjoy a lot of elements of sci-fi. I enjoy the suspension of disbelief that we can have when we read sci-fi, because I love both. And I think Dune is like the perfect melding of the two. You've got, you know, the fantasy aspect of this completely alien culture, but you've got the sci-fi aspect of sort of the technology and the mechanism by which we have magic in the world. And I really was drawn to that. And so I think that this next series is maybe playing a bit more heavily on some of the science fiction ideas, but definitely with a fantasy feel. The basic plot is like you've got this monk. He's in sort of an analog of like a Buddhist order. And when the story begins, you know, it begins, I'd say, somewhat similar to Scribes, where you've got this horrific act of violence carried out in the first chapter. This monk's entire monastery is wiped out by these invaders who, you know, have kind of lived on the border for a long time, but they've never actually invaded. And so they wipe out his family. They wipe out his all his monastic brothers. And, you know, he's kind of a bad monk. I mean, he's, you know, he likes to drink. He likes to smoke. He's, you know, he's not a good monk. But when his family is wiped out there, he kind of resolves that he's going to reach like full awakening so that he can kind of unlock these powers that people have in his world. So, you know, in this world, they have the third eye is real. The third eye can kind of destroy things at will. People can read minds in this world. People can levitate. You know, there's real spiritual powers that people can develop. And so he says to himself, like, okay, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to reach awakening. I'm going to go and I'm going to slaughter all of these invading troops. And the story kind of, you know, it gets a bit weird from there. He finds this artificial intelligence construct that's housed the teachings of this Buddhist order for like thousands of years in his world. And he kind of sets off on a bit of a one part hijinks adventure with this sentient machine and one part's brutal revenge action tale set in a sort of cross between, I guess, Eastern Europe and Japan or Korea. So I have no idea right now where it's really heading. It's definitely an interesting project, much different from Scribes in a lot of ways.
And you know, it's, I gotta say, it's part of the creative process. You start at one point and you end up somewhere completely different. And that's part of what gets you to the story at the end, right?
Sure. There's a lot of stepping stones, you might say. And some of them just come from these flashes of like, hey, that would be cool. You know, that would be something neat to put into the book. And you just kind of jot it down in a notebook. And, you know, maybe you've got the seed of your next entire series right there. All it takes is that one kind of nugget of inspiration, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you said something that's, I think, so important for anybody that's interested in being a writer, or anybody that's involved in creative ventures of any kind, even creative business ventures. Having a notebook, or even just using the notes app on your phone, is invaluable, because I can't tell you how many times I've had the perfect idea, and an hour later, I can't remember it to save my life. and through long periods of learning this lesson, not just once, but many times, I finally have gotten in the habit of either carrying a small notebook around in my pocket, or especially at conferences and things like that, or actually just pulling out my phone and jotting a note down on the notes app, just to keep the idea there. So when I'm back in my writing corner, I can pull it out and I can put it into my project. I have a database. I have a spreadsheet where I keep all my project ideas, large and small. Some of them are just chapter notes. Some of them are full story, you know, thoughts, and all of it's kept there. And, you know, for me to play around with when I'm ready to start on whatever the next project happens to be.
Have you tried voice recorder notes? I that's like my favorite tool in the world. When I'm walking somewhere or something, and I want to get a full idea out, but it's kind of too cumbersome to write, I just put on voice recorder and look like a crazy person, you know, walking down the street, like, and then the robot machine dog, you know, grows rocket launchers out of its ears and or whatever.
Well, and you know, it's funny. I do that a lot, because I just don't feel I can talk so much faster than I can type with my thumbs. So
that's it.
I use the little microphone on my phone, you know, little microphone button, and I just dictate my stuff into the phone, into the notes, and they do that. But I also now dictate all of my first drafts completely. So
really,
yeah, and it's a different, it took me a while to get over the hump of doing it. It took me like my fifth real try at doing it. But I finally stuck last year, and it's been very interesting experience, because I've gone from telling the story typing to really becoming an oral storyteller. And it's a different experience. And actually, you know, the way I use words is different when I talk the story rather than type the story.
That's fascinating. I have not heard anybody who has done actually a full draft that way. So I'm really quite impressed, actually.
Well, I started it last May, so it's been almost a full year now.
Have you been practicing, like, for example, I know that on a phone or whatever, if you're talking to Google, you have to kind of dictate every single piece of punctuation. Is that how it works?
I do that. I use an app called Just Press Record, which I don't know if there's an Android app that matches it, but there is. It is an iOS app, I know for sure. It'll transcribe whatever I've recorded in the background while I'm recording the next thing, and so that's kind of handy. But what I've given myself, the hardest thing to overcome is to give yourself permission to talk like a stuttering robot, and say things like that, you know, where you're actually talking like a slow William Shatner, actually. But, you know, once you give yourself permission to talk like that, and the dictation comes a lot easier. And yeah, you do have to do the punctuation and the open quote, close quote, you know, all that stuff. But, you know, I used to balk at it, and then I realized, you know, my fingers learned to do this. Right. I mean, you put in commas and punctuation automatically when you type after you learn to type. And it was just a question of teaching my mouth to do the same thing. And once my brain and my mouth connected in the same way my brain had been connecting to my hands all this time, it's become progressively more natural over time, to the point that I kind of get into that same flow state that I used to get into when I was typing. And you know, 10 minutes will go by and I didn't realize I was, you know, I didn't realize I'm out of my head and into the story, to the point that it's kind of becomes, you know, transparent.
That's great.
So yeah, it's a skill like anything else, and it takes practice, and it's not easy when you first do it. And it was really painful, but I just told myself, I'm going to do the whole book. I don't care how long it takes or what I need to do. I'm going to finish. And I did like 62,000 words of a first draft, just to bang it out. But I got those 62,000 words of that first draft in like 3.5 weeks.
That's super impressive.
Yeah,
definitely.
And you know, weeks. Yeah, it was ugly, and I needed to fix things and go back and make corrections because the transcription wasn't perfect. But it was still a lot faster than what I was doing before, and that was the
definitely.
Key. Yeah. So let's get back to you. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you? I know a lot of people. Some people go to cons. You're probably not near a lot of. I don't know if there's a lot of conventions. I've heard there's not a lot of con traffic in Europe in general.
Yeah. And ironically, I'm also not much of a traveler, despite living abroad. I don't like to travel
right,
that
dude,
much.
That's like, just hilarious.
It is. People are like, yeah, you know, I'm a real homebody. And I'm like, me too. You know, I'm over here in Eastern Europe, but I'm a homebody, you know, and I like my apartment. I like to hang out and, let's see, as far as contact methods, I would say that probably if people want to actually talk to me about, the story, or they're just super into something about the writing, or like they have a lore kind of question, I have no problem with people writing to me via my personal Facebook. I don't consider it a place like just for close family or friends. I mean, I'll use it to chat with anybody who wants to have a chat. People can write to me or tag me or whatever on Twitter if it's something that that they feel comfortable using, but I find Twitter's a bit cumbersome for chatting and stuff like that, so probably better for Facebook. People can also email me, although that's a bit of an old-fashioned thing, and usually there's no real reason to email, but if people feel comfortable doing that, then, you know, by all means, I guess tweet to me or Facebook me and I'll give you my email. But, you know, it's a bit circuitous at that point, isn't it? Those are the two best, probably, would be Twitter and Facebook.
Excellent. Well, and we'll make sure that we, connect people up to your website as well, and connect you to people so they can find you and be able to find your next project when you get it squared away and are ready to announce it in full. They'll be able to be part of the process. And in the meantime, read The Scribe Cycle. It's fascinating. I can't wait to continue digging into book one and just find out what's going on with Anna, because it's caught me pretty quickly, and I think it will catch all of you as well. James, thanks for coming on the show. It's great to have you. And please, when you have that other project ready to go and you're ready to release another book, get back in touch with me and we'll have you back on.
All right. Thank you very, very much. It's been a real pleasure to stop by and chat. A lot of cool food for thought, and I'll have to try dictating a novel and apparently working on my vocabulary.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. Make sure you catch up with us online for a whole lot more from the fantasy-focused community, both on Facebook and over at fantasy-focus.com. Leave a comment on this episode. Let me know what's on your mind. I'd love to hear from you. Also, over on the website, on each of the podcast episode pages, you'll find links to subscribe to the show. So make sure you do that. You don't want to miss any of the episodes, and you can subscribe any way you want. You can get an email. You can subscribe using apps like Stitcher or TuneIn or any of your favorite podcasting apps for iOS or Android. We have some pretty awesome guests coming along in the next month or so, and you don't want to miss any of them, including our next awesome episode with MJ Vieira coming up in the next show. That's it for this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Jamie Davis, author of Fun Fantasy Reads. Don't forget to follow me over on Facebook at Jamie Davis Books and at my website, jamiedavisbooks.com, where you can, if you want, get a free book just for signing up for my newsletter while you're there. Whatever you do, though, subscribe and come back for the next podcast. And in the meantime, I'm reminding you to keep your eyes open, because there's magic all around you.